Good morning. So last time we went through an example of everything about the C++ language, how classes worked, as far as copy constructors. We saw one important gotcha, which is that if you want to declare a variable foo and have the default constructor be called, you do it without parentheses, even though everywhere else, like with new, parentheses work, and the constructor has parentheses in its declaration, but you can't use it for declaring a variable calling that constructor. And you saw an example of defining an own output operator for a type, which is something you might want to do in the future. And we saw some other interesting things, like that the copy constructor gets used when you pass something by value to a function to create the local variable that's the argument. And we started talking about vector, which is the C++ equivalent of ArrayList. So before I move on to that, any questions about C++ topics from before? Okay. So I showed you this example of our vector. So we declare it very similarly to how you declare it a vector, an array list in Java. Here we're not like saying equals new because that, you know, we don't have a pointer. And if we just do this, it calls the default constructor. So it works fine. We can use pushback, which is the equivalent of append. And we can access it like an array for the most part. And we talked about why we're going to use this instead of raw arrays. And most of these are the same sort of reasons that you see in Java, that you can't resize arrays. Just like in Java, you have to allocate a new one. You can't assign arrays with equal. This is kind of true in Java. You arrays are references in Java and C++. You just can't do it. If you have a real array and if you have a pointer, you have a pointer to an array and you're changing where it points to, not the original array. And arrays in C++ do not track capacity and do not have bounce checking, which are things we might want that vector can give us. So let's talk about the methods of vector, actually. So this one is the one you saw. This is how you write the override an operator for indexing. You just omit everything but the special characters to write the operator name. And so that's the indexing operator. And there's also a method at, and these are different. And the difference is that at, if you access something out of bounds, will throw an exception. Now, I don't think we're going to go over how to catch exceptions, but if you don't catch an exception, it's guaranteed that your application will actually terminate. This, the indexing operator here, it's not going to do that. It's just going to compute a memory location, access memory there, and whatever happens, happens. If you're lucky, it'll crash and your program will stop. If you aren't, you might be modifying some memory that's like part of a different vector. Yeah. So these are part of the vector class. So if you pound include vector, somewhere in there, there's this declaration exists. And notice that both of these return a reference, so we can assign to them the result, which is why, well, we didn't see an example here, but it's going to be legal to actually assign like you would to an array because these are returning a reference. There's also a front and back for getting the first and last element. You could, of course, use dot size minus one or zero instead, and the indexing operators. And all of these functions have const variants. So if you remember I told you earlier, we could have methods with the same name and arguments, but one mark const and one not. And that is something the C++ standard library does. So this means if we have a const reference to a vector, which the most common case is you have a function which takes in a vector and you don't want to modify it, but you don't want to copy it. Like if you just took in a vector by value, it would be whole copied. And you like have 1,000 elements, you don't want to do that, so you take in a const reference, but you still want to use dot front and back. And if this was the only method that exists, well, that's not a const method, and you could modify the thing returned so that we wouldn't want that. So there's an additional method, which is const, which returns a constant reference to make sure that you can't modify it, and you can still call it on the const reference, even though you're not supposed to change that version of the vector. And you can use, as I said, these return values to modify things like this. And the same with, sample of 2 = 3, like you would with an array. Okay, any questions on any of this? Yeah.
So if you declare the original vector as constant, it'll only use the constant method?
Yeah, so if I didn't have a reference, but I did const vector int foo, then I could only use the const methods on foo. This would not be very useful because I would have no way of adding elements to foo. But maybe it would be useful if I were doing something like foo and parentheses example, in which case I would have an unmodifiable copy of example. Because I call the constructor which takes another vector. Yes?
Can you do example square bracket index square bracket equals 3?
Yes. This is what I was trying to show here, but my handwriting on this tablet is pretty bad today. Yes, so you can absolutely do that. Okay, there's also some functions to return a size and capacity. So like, did you use capacities in Java? ArrayList capacity, reserve? No, okay. So the implementation of vectors is that they have, internally, they contain, so we have a vector, and internally it contains an array pointer and a size and a capacity. And the array has capacity elements, but only size of them are actually used. So you can get at both of those values. The size is the like maximum element. The capacity is how much more you can add without having that array reallocated. And so there's a method reserve for changing the for making the capacity bigger without changing the size, which you can call as a just strictly an optimization if you want to make the vector handle becoming bigger faster. And resize, which actually changes the size, reallocating the array if it needs to. And there's a clear, which set is the same as resizing to 0. Yes?
So do you have to use the resize method every time you use, like, you push the new element?
The question is, do I have to use the resize method every time I want to change the size? And the answer is no. So the methods which append and prepend, they will adjust the size for you. They will do the resize and change the last, or in the case of the prepend, the first element. So push back, pop back is called so called because it changes things at the back of the vector, the last element. And there's push front and pop front, which change things at the front. While these are methods that exist, they are linear time, O of n, so you probably should avoid using them. And there, you should, if you want to use both push back and push front, you probably should use a different data structure, which we'll talk maybe about later in the semester, possibly today. Okay, and vector is one of many examples of what the C++ standard library has for container classes. And you may hear the term standard template library used to refer to these. So historically, before C++ was standardized the first time, there was this very, very popular separate library, I think originally from SGI, called the standard template library, which got incorporated into the C++ standard. And that's where these come from. And we'll learn where the term template comes from in a second. So these container classes, we have vector, string, there's a list class, which is a doubly linked list, there's map and hash map, there's a stack, which we'll learn about more today, there's a deck for a double-ended queue, which I don't know, powerful, and a bunch more. And they share common methods and an iterator interface we'll talk about a bit later. And when I say share common methods, basically there's this convention like that the append function's always going to be called pushback and so on. It's not guaranteed that all of them have all the methods. For example, you know, some of these won't have pushback and things like that, but they try to share method names so you can use them the same way. It's not like java.util where there's like an interface that these implement. That's not the case in C++. So in this class, you can use any standard library classes, except basically when the lab tells you not to, or if it would obviously defeat the point of the lab. Like if the point of the lab is to implement a stack, like our next week's lab, you may not use the C++ standard library's stack class for that. And if the point of the lab is to implement a hash table, you can't use hash map, which is a hash table. If you have questions, ask, but we would otherwise encourage you to take advantage of the C++ standard library. People writing real programs do not re-implement every data structure every time they need it when there's this convenient implementation in the standard library that is probably better than anything you can come up with in a weekend. At least hopefully better. Hopefully better than that. And our recommendation, is just use it. There's documentation for this. You don't just have to like crib from my slides and make guesses for the things I haven't told you about. So my recommendation, and this is linked from next week's lab, is this website, which is a convenient reference. It is not a tutorial. It has examples, but it is not a tutorial. It is like not intended to be read from cover to cover and figure out how to use these things. It's more like, I think there's a way of like appending to this. How do I do that? That sort of place to find. This refers to different versions of the C++ standard. So it refers to C++ 11, 14, 17, 20, which are the 2011, 2014, 2017, and upcoming 2020. Version of the C++ standard. We won't generally be using those features. By default, they're not supported on our grading machine. But they will be documented, and if you work commercially, you might get the pleasure of being able to use those. And probably in the future, we will have our grading server set up so you can use some of those, but involves upgrading old machines. Okay, so another thing about the standard library is some of the classes you've used are actually generic classes. So you saw that we have, like you're used to in Java, we have these vector of type. Some of the classes in the C++ standard library are actually those. So standard string is an alias for this thing called standard basic string of char. Because the standard library supports having strings composed of other types of characters. And standard OStream and iStream are basic OStream and basic iStream of char, because you can have output streams that output other types of characters. And I'm mentioning this mainly because when you look this up in a reference, you'll be like, where's string? There's this basic string thing, but where's string? That's just where string is. So any questions about this? Okay, so one thing I mentioned when talking about containers is we have this iterator interface. And this should remind you of what you're doing for lab this week, that you had to implement an iterator. And the interface in the standard library classes is coincidentally pretty similar, though the syntax will look pretty different. So like your list iterator, these represent a position. And they're kind of designed to work like a pointer. So in your list iterator, the iterator literally is just a wrapper for a pointer. And generally, that's what iterators for the C++ container classes will be. They'll be a wrapper for a pointer to something. But they could be represented in some other way. You know, you'll just access them through methods, so you won't actually get to see how they're implemented. So for a vector, like one way of implementing it is a pointer. One way of implementing it is with a reference to the vector and an index. These are both things that could have happened in the library. You don't get to see which one because you just see the public methods. So in vector, there are two methods within the vector class which return an iterator. And I'll show you what the iterator type looks like in a second. I'm just writing iterator right now. So there's one called begin, which returns an iterator for the first element. So that's probably similar to what you were doing. And there's one called end, and you would think that would return an iterator whose position is the position of the last element in the vector, but that is not the case. It is, in fact, the position one past the end. So it's as if there's a dummy element at the after the end of what's in the vector, and the iterator points there. And iterators have lots of overloaded operators, which is mostly how you use them. So if you want to make them go forwards, use the plus plus operator. If you want to make them go backwards, use minus minus. If you want to get the thing at their current position, use the dereference operator. That's what I meant by saying they act like pointers. And you can even use the arrow dereference operator. That's also overloaded to work correctly if the iterator is giving you the position of an object. And you can check compare positions by comparing with equality, inequality, and so on. Yes?
Is there any difference between the positions of plus plus and minus minus?
So the question is there any difference between these two versions of plus plus and minus minus? So the general rule is that this is returns the old position, and this returns the new position. So that's the conceptual difference. In lots of commercial C++ code, you'll see people strongly prefer these versions. And the reason for that is that sometimes returning the old position means making a copy of the current iterator to return and then changing the original. And that can be slower if the compiler can't figure out how to get rid of that. Usually the compiler can, but not always. So you'll often see code that uses iterators, like this next slide, be canonically written with plus plus instead at the beginning instead of the end, even though both would work. Okay, so this is some iterator code. So this is how the iterator type is a member of the vector class. So you write the type of your vector, colon, colon, iterator, and that's the type of the iterator that's, for example, begin returns. And this is our canonical way of doing the equivalent of for each. And this works not only with vector, but with essentially all the other container classes in the C++ standard library. You can use this exact same code, just replace vector with list or map or whatever, and this is will iterate through the entire container. And you notice that because the end is one past the end, we're checking for inequality with it, because we don't want to actually access one past the end. That's how we know when we're done. So, any questions about this code? Yes.
In this case, does it matter on the incrementer for the it if the plus plus is in front or in the back?
So, question, can you do this? This is legal and equivalent. If the compiler isn't clever, it might be slower. I think most compilers for vector will figure this out. We'll figure out how to make them exactly equivalent. For some other container types, it might be harder. The issue being, as I said, that conceptually what the plus plus operator does is it returns a copy of the old iterator and changes the current one, whereas the pre-increment changes the current one and returns it, so it makes one less copy. But the compiler often can figure out, oh, we're returning this copy that we don't need, let's just not do the copy at all. But not always. And they're certainly both always correct. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so like in your list class that you're implementing for the post lab, there are methods on vector which take iterators. So there's a method to insert something in the middle of the vector, or at the end, if you pass the iterator that's one past the end. It inserts before the position, which is a deliberate choice because the end iterator is one past the end, so this lets you insert at every single location in the vector. So you pass begin, you insert before the prepend, you pass end, you append, and so on. There's erase. I think position after, I'm not sure that's actually correct. And there's this range erase, which erases from start up to and not including end. And this is a pattern you will often see in the C++ standard library, that they have functions which take a first and a last, and they do something from first up to but not including the last. This is, again, ties with end being one past the end. So this means, for example, there's this function sort in the standard library, which takes two iterators of any kind, which has this convention, and if you pass vector.begin, vector.end, begin is the first element, end is one past the end, so this begin up to but not including one past the end is the whole vector, so that sorts the whole vector. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so you can also modify values with iterators. So the operator overload for dereferencing returns a reference. So you can actually modify that value like you would any other reference. So in this case, we increment all the elements in the vector. And since I talked about const earlier, you might wonder how does this mean iterators work if we have a const vector? So in that case, you might have to use a different type. So here I have a function where I want to just print out a vector, so I'm taking in a const reference because I want to promise that, hey, I'm printing out your vector, I'm not, like, modifying all its values. But in order to use an iterator, I need to use this other type of iterator, a const iterator that will return a const reference, so it won't let me do modifying the vector like this. That's why print, you can print it out. It can't actually like do increment each of the values by one in addition. Yeah, so if I try to do that, I will just get a compile time error. So any questions about iterators? Okay, so yeah, hopefully those are pretty familiar since you're practicing implementing them, kind of, something like that. Just these have a bit more terse syntax. To talk about next is the other language feature we've kind of been dancing around, which is templates. So these are C++'s equivalent to generics. And they work a bit differently than generics in Java. So in Java, the way generics work is something called type erasure. So in Java, there's this common superclass object. Everything can be an object. And generics are just special syntax for basically casting to and from object whenever necessary. In C++, we do not have a common type, like object, that we can convert things to. And instead, templates are basically fill in the blank, that you have code with some missing type, and the compiler will literally generate a separate version for each thing you put in the blank. It will actually compile a new version of the method for each possible type you use with it. So for example here, I have a template function. So first I say I have a template thing of some sort. And I say I have something to fill in, and I'm using the word type name to indicate I am filling in some sort of type name called comparable. You can also write, instead of type name, you can write class. And yes, this is true even if you're filling it in with int, even though int is not a class. We will write type name every time we use templates, but if you read real code, you might see class. It's exactly the same as type name. So here, our fill in the blank is, we return a reference to whatever that type is and take a vector of whatever that type is. And we have some simple implementation here that iterates through the vectors in a sort of classical for loop way, not with iterators, and does a bunch of comparisons. And you note that this comparison is done on whatever type comparable is. So in this case, we're using finMax. We have a vector. We presumably, make a 37-element vector, presumably set those elements to something. And then we ask for the maximum value and print it out. And when we do this call, our compiler is going to generate the code created by replacing comparable every time with int. So it's going to generate this method for us. And that's what we're going to end up calling. And it's going to act exactly as if we actually wrote this method, this version of the method in our code. So we have all our replacements. And of course, we can call this with some other class. So we could have a vector of strings. And we get the same thing. It would be the exact same comparison. And this will work because, like int, we can. It turns out we're going to be able to compare strings with less than. And we can have a vector of strings. So we'll do the substitution. It will compile that. And we'll have this other version of finMax, which will find the maximum string, which is presumably the latest alphabetically, if we have a list of like English words. And you might say, what happens if we use it with a class, some other arbitrary class, where, you know, maybe we don't have a that isn't comparable? So let's say we had an old incel class. You remember, we probably didn't remember to define a comparison operator on our incel class. And if we don't define in our own operator, classes by default don't have any comparison semantics. So doing this comparison on incels is an error. And what's going to happen is the compiler lets you write this template, but when you try to use it with incel, it's going to give you a compile error saying, hey, I looked how to do a comparison, I couldn't do it, sorry. So it's going to produce this code, it's going to try to compile it, say, nope, that doesn't compile, and it's going to fail to make your template function exist. So any questions about this function template? Okay. So we can also have template classes. So here we put our template and our type name before a class. And again, it's all this fill in the blank. We have instances of that type name somewhere in the class, and every instance is going to be replaced, and the compiler is going to generate a new version of this class for every type. Because we need to actually indicate which version we're using every time, because we need to write object cell, you need to know what is type name, we're going to have the whatever these braces are called to indicate the type, just like you did in Java. And that's going to mean fill in the blank object with int. If we do that and create that class. And so once we have that, we can use it and call its methods. And it's as if we had written something like class object cell int, and every other instance of int replaced in that. Except that you can't actually call a class that. Class something with that special character. Greater than and less than. And so we define that, and we can use it like so. We can call set value, we can call get value, it returns the appropriate type, depending on what we have being contained. So I've shown you sort of the simplest example of templates. Templates support a whole bunch of other features. So one notable thing is you can have templates which take multiple type parameters. Classic example is map. You have a key and a value. Yes, you can have that as multiple type name parameters. You might wonder, why are we writing type name or class here? Why don't we just have a list of key value? Why is the compiler making us write extra? Well, it turns out you can put other stuff there. So you can have a template parameterized by a constant in addition to a type. And it works exactly the same way. When you ask for the version of this class with a particular size, the compiler is going to replace the size with that constant you provide and produce a different version for each size you provide. This also means that you have to write buffer with a actual size that's a constant. You can't like put a variable there. You can also have default parameters. So here we're saying we have a value type and a size, but we set default values for them. And if we don't fill in those parameters, the compiler will use the default when deciding what version to generate and use. Any questions about any of these variants? Yeah.
Is there any difference between using this kind of like template, like the memory difference?
Is there any difference between using this versus like having an actual parameter?
So is there a difference in memory, like memory usage?
So the question is there a difference in memory? So templates, when we have different versions of the template, The compiler literally generates separate code for each one. So, like, if you defined, like, if you had a buffer for every possible size from 1 to 4096, you'd have 4096 different compiled code versions of buffer in your program. Of course, and presumably the reason you have this size here is because hard coding the size will make your code more efficient in some way, hopefully. Okay, so other issue with templates is how do we declare them? And so far I've told you that we put our declarations in the .h file, and then we can use them from a CPP file. So you might say, okay, so I guess I declare a template like this. You know, I just take my implementation I showed you earlier, I get rid of the curly braces stuff and put a semicolon. That's a forward, that's a prototype. I just put that in my header file and that should work. And you can try to do this and you'll get this sort of error. You'll get a linker error. It will compile, but then the compiler will say, huh, I do not have find max of int. And this is even if I include my CPP file where I have that implementation I showed you earlier. So templates are an exception to the rule we talked about earlier that you just need a declaration and the compiler would do it. And the reason is that the compiler needs to know what versions to generate. And it only knows it needs to generate findmax for int if it sees a use of that. And so what you have to do instead is you'll do something like put the implementation in the header file. And this, for templates, is guaranteed not to trigger errors about multiply defining findmax. The compiler will prevent that from happening, even if you use, say, findmax of int from three different C++ files, so they're all going to have their own version. The compiler will somehow deal with not producing multiple versions of it in your final executable, even though, you know, we wouldn't expect that to happen for a normal function. For a normal function, if you put the implementation in the header file and use it for multiple functions, you'll get an error, multiple files, you'll get an error saying you defined this function multiple times. Templates are an exception to that because you have to have the implementation available to know what variants to create. So this is a common pattern you'll see. Like, they might have a forward declaration, but somewhere in the header file, possibly after the part people might read, they'll put the actual implementation. Another pattern you might see is including a different header file to have the implementations just to make the main header file easier to read. They're both the same because header files are just included as just copying and pasting the text. But these are both things you might see commonly done for templates because we have to have the templates available in every C++ file we use them with their implementations. So the compiler can do the fill in the blank operation. So any questions about that? Yeah?
If you already have an implementation of the findmax in the header file, you don't have to implement the method in the CPP file, right?
This question is, if you have an implementation in the header file, you don't have to implement it in the CPP file. Yes, in fact, you cannot, because when you compile that CPP file, presumably you're including that header file and the compiler's going to say, you defined findmax twice in the same C++ file. What are you doing? Okay, so our next topic is going to be about stacks. So stacks are a data structure which have multiple implementations, which we'll happen to be implementing next week. And stacks are kind of like a list. And they have two designated locations. They have a top and a bottom. And everything we're going to do is going to deal with the top of the stack. And we have two operations we can perform on a stack. So one operation is we can push a new value, in which case we get a new top value that goes on top, that's the term, of the other. So all the original values in the stack are still there. We just add one, and it's now called the top. And we have pop, which removes the top and makes what was top before it the top again. Top before that A was pushed, B was the top. If we pop, B is the top again. And so we have this property that these are our only two operations, and all our operations are only going to touch the top of the stack, which means the rest of the stack is hidden from us. I'm going to like draw pictures of it and so on, but we're not actually going to have a way to look at other parts of the stack without doing something like popping everything above them off the stack first. And so generally when we talk about our stack, we're going to have, implement this concretely, we're going to think about, if we're implementing like a class, having basically four methods. We have push, pop, and we have some things to read the state of the stack. But we only get to learn about the top, so the two things we'll have are something to read the top value and something to check if the stack is empty. Is there a top at all? These are the only operations we're going to have. And the reason we're talking about stack is even though this seems like a less capable and much more boring than, say, vector, which can do a lot more than this, these are sufficient and useful for implementing certain problems. So let's go through some example applications, starting with probably the most intuitive, which is if I want to implement undo. So I have a text editor, I want control Z to do the right thing, and I need to keep track of what operations did we do, did the user do, so they can do, and so they can undo the most recently undone one. And the value we most recently pushed is the top of the stack, so the stack actually works reasonably well for this. So we have our top of the stack is our most recent operation, and this is what we want to undo first. Then we have our next operation, which we pushed on before it, which is what we want to undo next, and so on. So the undo operation is just look at the top of the stack, do the inverse of that, and then pop. And the do operation is push something onto the stack so we can undo it later. So any questions about this? So another example application is parentheses matching. So we have like a text editor, we want to match where different types of brackets and parentheses go, so you can tell the user, hey, you probably missed a closing brace somewhere or something like that, or closing parentheses. And a straightforward way of doing this is by using a stack and going through our text file or our string to figure out what thing parentheses are we in and what aren't we to match that. So the algorithm here is we're going to look at each symbol, and if it's an opening parentheses or brace or something like that, we're going to push it onto the stack. If it's a closing one, we're going to check if the stack is not empty and the top of the stack has the opposite symbol. So if we have a closing parentheses, the top of the stack should have an opening one because it should be the most recently added thing we just pushed. And if so, we'll pop. Otherwise, we'll say, oh, they're mismatched. There's an error. You probably have a mistake in your code. And at the end, when we get to the end of file or the end of the string, we'll check if the stack is not empty. And if it is not empty, we're going to say you have an error. You didn't close some opening brace or something like that. So you can see I have an example of what that algorithm looks like. So here we have a string of a bunch of braces. We look at our first symbol. It's an opening symbol, so we're going to push it onto our stack. So now here is the top of our stack. Then we have another opening symbol. We push it, so our top of our stack is this square brace. Then we have a parentheses, another opening symbol. We push it, so the top of our stack is that parentheses. Then we have a closing symbol, and we say, is the stack not empty? Yep. Is the top the opposite of this parenthesis, opposite of this symbol we're looking at here? Yes. So we're going to say, okay, that's not an error, and we're going to pop it off the stack, which is putting a line through it. So now our top of a stack is this opening square brace. And then we see another square brace. We push that onto the stack, opening square brace. And then we see its corresponding closing one. So we pop that off the stack. And then we see an opening parentheses. We do the same thing and then push it onto the stack. A closing parentheses, we check the top of the stack. It's an opening parentheses, it matches. Closing one, and then we see a closing brace, and we say, oh, this is, the stack is not empty, but the top is not an opening brace. It's, in fact, a square bracket, an opening square bracket, so that's a mismatched error, so we say, oh, this is mismatched. And in fact, you know, the string we wanted, the string that would actually make this not mismatched is if we had an extra closing square brace there, which is pretty easy to see when you go through these careful steps of keeping track of what things have been open and what haven't. But like not obvious by just glancing at that string. Okay. So any questions about this application, what the stack is doing here when we're pushing, popping? Okay, so another application is postfix calculators. So there's something called a postfix expression. I'll show you later. Who's seen this before at all? Okay, so a surprising number of you. So this is an expression where an infix expression means we have number, operator, number. Postfix expressions means we have number, number, operator. So we write some numbers and then the operations we do on them after that. And a stack is the most natural implementation technique for a postfix calculator, and this is part of what you'll be doing for the labs next week. So here I have a postfix expression, and this is the equivalent infix expression. We're not going to have you actually convert between the two, but I'm just showing it to make it clearer what's going on. And the algorithm for evaluating a postfix expression with a stack is if we see a number, we push it onto the stack. If we see an operator, we take the top of the stack and pop it, take the next thing on the stack and pop it, and then push the result of the operator on those two things. And maybe I have the order wrong, but of the operator probably should actually be, this probably should be B op A. For reasons we'll see later. So for example, if I go through this expression in order, I see first I have two numbers, so I push one, push the other. That's what I got on my stack. I do have a times, that's an operator, so I'm gonna do this operation. I'm gonna pop 7 and 3 and multiply them together and push that result. So I take my 7 and 3, I pop both of them, and I pushed 7 times 3, 21. Then I have a bunch of numbers, 4, 7, and 8. I push each of them, run after the other, onto the stack. Then I have a division. So I'm going to pop the top two things and divide them. And you see why I had the order wrong here for division, and get 7 eighths. Seven eighths from doing the division. Then next I have a multiplication, so I'm gonna pop the top two things on my stack. So the 7/8 I got from the division and the 4 I got from, 4 that was pushed just earlier. So I'm going to multiply them and get 7/2. And then my final operation is plus, so I'm going to pop 7/2 and 21 from the stack, add them together, and get, assuming I did this correctly earlier, 49/2. So does this make sense, what we're doing here? And so this is a way of doing, of you know, giving you the ability to do calculations, pretty much any calculation. without having to actually write the code to figure out how to parse all these parentheses and operator precedents. So we're going to, so you're going to implement this. So this would be a simple, usable calculator. Take a little bit of a learning curve because you have to write your math in what many people consider an unnatural way. That's something you can do. So we'll continue talking about stacks next time. And that we're okay.